relativistic relative of Green-Schwarz superstring on ADS5 process 5.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation, for the opportunity to present our work in this very nice conference and environment. Well, I'm going to talk about try to summarize some recent work aimed towards the quantization of the theories which via Vermeer reduction, they are relativistic theories which are equivalent to the Worksheet theories of strings and superstrings. So this work is in collaboration with Ben Hoare, who is here, and Tim Hollow from Swansea, and well, you can find more details in any of these papers. Well, here's the plan of the talk. First of all, I will say a few words about the kind of models we are working with. I will not describe Vermeer reduction. It was very nicely summarized at the beginning of the week. And then I will jump quickly into the model of interest, which is the relativistic theory, which is equivalent, classically equivalent to the Worksheet theory of ADS5, COSS5, Green-Schwarz theory. And then well, I will go through certain steps that we have followed. I mean, the program is not completed yet, but hopefully it will be interesting. So the kind of theories collectively are called symmetric space and Gordon theories, because they are based on symmetric spaces, and they are known in the literature since very long ago, so since the work actually of Vermeer in the mid-70s. So they are relativistic integral theories in two dimensions, which are classically equivalent via Vermeer reduction to the non-relativistic gauge-fixed Worksheet theories of strings on spacetimes built out of symmetric spaces like this one. So these are examples which are relevant in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So then I remark, because it will appear many times in the talk, these models are relativistic, and they are supposed to be equivalent to a non-relativistic thing. And this is part of the interest of his understanding this relationship. Well, they enter into the game of ADS-CFT correspondence in several ways, but the most recent one maybe is because they have soliton solutions, which for these particular classes are the images of the string giant magnons. And then from that point of view, the classical aspects of this model have become very useful. Well, these models, the previous models were bosonic, so if I want to describe the superstring with all the fermionic degrees of freedom, I need to generalize the class, or the class has to be generalized to the case where the symmetric space is changed by what is called a semi-symmetric space, and we'll call them the models semi-symmetric space and Gordon theories, which is something, well, that involves now, it's like a quotient of a supergroup by a bosonic group, G, and that involves a zeta 4 automorphism, such that the G is the fixed set, the fixed invariant subgroup. And then this gives rise to the algebra decomposition like this, where the grades are correspond to even, not even, of generators. So these were classified long ago by Serganova, and more recently in this context by Sarembo. So examples of these semi-symmetric spaces which are relevant in this context are these two. I mean, for to describe superstrings on ADS-fast process 5, is this semi-symmetric space, PSU 224 divided by this, which is the one that we'll be talking about. And this for ADS4 CP3 will be this. Okay, so I will not give you any detail, as I said, about how to construct these models, but I will just go to the one I'm interested. So that means, the starting point of the talk will be to remind that the relativistic then semi-symmetric space theory for this symmetric space coset, semi-symmetric space coset, then is classically equivalent to the non-relativistic gauge-fixed Green-Schwarz superstring Worksheet theory on ADS-fast process 5. The equivalence goes through a fermionic generalization of Vermeer reduction worked out by these people. Okay, so this is a classical equivalence. And in general, one can start making questions. In general, one should not expect that the thing goes beyond. So in general, one should expect that the equivalence is purely classical, and there is a good reason for that. And the reason is that, okay, the equations of motion of the models are the same, but the Hamiltonian structures are different. This is what happens, for instance, in the original models, which was Sine-Gordon versus the O3 sigma model. But the equivalence has been conjectured to remain in the quantum theory corresponding to ADS5 process 5 because it is conformal invariance, has been conjectured by Grigoriev and Seitlin. And then from that point of view, one can formulate this thing of there are different Hamiltonian structures in a nicer way, so to escape the problem. Noticing that the two Hamiltonian structures are what is called compatible, which means that any linear combination of the Poisson brackets is an admissible Poisson bracket. And in that sense, that means the family of Poisson brackets can be written as an interpolating family from one model to the other. We will see that something like that seems to emerge in the quantum theory. Well, this equivalence has already passed several tests. It were summarized nicely in Arkady Seitlin's talk. So, it has been shown that the semi-symmetric space and Gordon theory is finite, UV-finite. And then it has been calculations of the semi-classical partition function, which matches with the string theory at one loop. And he was announcing in his talk that even at two loops, it seems that the result remains, the agreement remains. But from our point of view, I mean, the proper way to address the quantum equivalence is needs to find what is the exact relativistic schematics of the semi-symmetric space of the relativistic theory, and then try to compare or clarify the relationship with the already known superstring schematics. And then anyway, I mean, this is supposed interesting in the context of ADS-CFT, but from the point of view of the integrable model itself, it's a very interesting problem, actually. So the approach we are following is follows the canonical semi-classical quantization approach. So we focus not on the Lagrangian perturbation theory, more on the solitons. So we study the spectrum of solitons. Knowing that due to experience with previous models, the perturbative fields always reappear in the spectrum. Then the idea is to quantize that solitonic spectrum to get a semi-classical spectrum, and from there be able to conjecture this matrix. So this I will go through a little bit the steps we have already completed. So this model we are talking about, I show here Lagrangian, will be a Lagrangian action. And it has this structure. First of all, it's this is a Gauge-Westermino-Witten term corresponding to a coset, which is G. G is the bosonic group which appears in the denominator of semi-symmetric space, and H, which is another group that we'll define shortly. Then it has potential, which is a bosonic potential, which is fixed by this element lambda, which has grade 2 in that decomposition that was involved in the construction of the semi-symmetric space. And that lambda actually fixes the gauge group of the Gauge-Westermino-Witten. It's like the centralizer of these lambdas. In this case, it's 4 copies of SU2. And then it has some fermionic terms, which are rather simple. They are quadratic in the fermion fields. And here, the coupling constant is what plays the role of coupling constant is the level of the Westermino-Witten term. And, well, in principle, we assume that it is quantized. Well, this in order to discover the integrability properties, the best way is to go to the equations of motion. Equations of motion can be written in zero curvature form in normal way, so the last connections are these. And they involve a spectral parameter, theta, which ensure classical integrability. But from there, one can discover two interesting things. So the first thing is that the equations are relativistic. And actually, Lorentz transformations are equivalent to rescalings of the spectral parameter, which is going to be important. And another interesting thing is that the integrability structure and the lax connections can be associated not to a PS224, but to a twisted affine Lie algebra constructed from them, and where the twisting is fixed by the automorphism, the theta-4 automorphism used in the construction of the symmetric space. Well, not all these algebras are algebra of symmetries. So the symmetries correspond to the generators of this infinite algebra that commute, that are compatible with the potential, so they commute with that element lambda, so it'll be something like that. And this will provide an infinite classical symmetry algebra, which actually the structure is very interesting. What makes it interesting is that if one looks at the elements of this algebra of grade plus or minus one, which correspond to the Lorentz spin one plus and minus half, actually one notices that they are supersymmetry generators. And then they generate a supersymmetry algebra whose closure is actually an 8-8 algebra, which is isomorphic to this. So it's two copies of PSU22, with two central extensions, and that can be decomposed according to the gradation involved in the loop algebra like this, such that the generators of a grade plus and minus two, which correspond to Lorentz spin plus and minus one, are actually the central elements, and they correspond to the components of the worksheet momentum. The generators of grade plus minus one are the supersymmetry generators, and then the generators of grade zero, which are Lorentz spin zero, they generate global gauge transformations in the Weston-Minowitten theory, and they play the role of a non-abelian R-symmetry group, which again is four copies of SU2. Well, what is funny here is that this S is a finite supersymmetry algebra, but I mean, has the structure is like a finite loop algebra, and actually it's a finite loop algebra of this loop algebra. It's a finite loop algebra of this infinite loop algebra, which is made of two copies of PSU22, and where the twisting is given again by the zeta 4 automorphism. And here, the Lorentz boost, because this is a relativistic theory, correspond to the derivation with respect to the spectral parameter. Well, these symmetries I was describing, they are coming from the equations of motion, so they are on shell symmetries, but one can check that actually those SUSY transformations, those supersymmetry transformations, are symmetries of the Lagrangian off shell, but they act non-locally on the Lagrangian fields. So this non-locality leads to a first conjecture, and the conjecture is that the symmetry algebra will become Q-deform in the quantum semi-symmetric space and Gordon's theory. So this will be a conjecture, working conjecture. Sorry. Then our symmetry is going to be not PS22 squared with two central extensions, but the Q deformation. And the deforming parameter will be fixed in terms of K. I will tell in the next transparency how. Well, at this step, we can make a little comparison with the string theory. And first thing one sees is that this symmetry algebra is different to the symmetry algebra of the superstring S matrix. Because that symmetry algebra is PS22 squared, the same, with three central extensions. That's not very important. But this is Q-deform, and this is not. Anyway, I mean, I don't know how important is this, but it is true that both things can be written in terms of the same loop algebra, which seems to be behind everything. And then the symmetry algebra of the superstring could be seen also as a subalgebra of the same loop algebra, but now with a central extension. Well, the importance of that is not clear yet. Well, this is concerns the symmetries. Now, the next step is to analyze the soliton spectrum. As I said, our analysis relies on the properties of the solitons. And this theory has a very rich spectrum. So it has a classical soliton spectrum of relativistic, well, we call them non-abelian Q-ball kings, because they are rather peculiar solitons, that because they have both non-trivial boundary conditions, but they carry Noether charges. So that's why they call them Q-ball kings, with bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. So they are labeled by an angle variable that takes values between 0 and 2 pi. The mass is given by this formula. And what is important is that they carry a rather non-trivial moduli space, which is this. Well, this, as I said, they have fermionic and bosonic degrees of freedom, and all the fermionic degrees of freedom, the Grassmann coordinates, actually, in this case, arise from the ADS part. So which means that if I turn off all the Grassmann coordinates, what I recover are solitons living in S5. So in that sense, they are like the supersymmetrization of the solitons corresponding to giant magnons. And then another interesting thing is that on this moduli space, since it is SU22 with some quotients, the supersymmetry group that you have detected act in a natural way. So this is the classical spectrum. So then how to proceed? Well, the way to proceed is to quantize that moduli space dynamics. That the quantization follows more or less standard tricks that some people, if I say Manton-style quantization, I just give you the result. I mean, the result is that out of that classical spectrum, what we get is a semi-classical spectrum of soliton made of a Hilbert space of short atypical representations of the Susi algebra of dimension 4A, with the mass spectrum given by this formula that, if you notice, is the same one as before, but with the angle becoming quantized. So is this. But since originally here there were an angle parameter, now the values of A have a maximal limit, which is given by the level of the Western Minuitin term. So this is a truncated spectrum of solitons, which has become discrete, as I said that already. And then from here, one can already detect the perturbative modes so that the spectrum is complete. So you put A equal to 1, you go to the lightest soliton, one can identify that lightest soliton with the perturbative states, and then for a larger values of A larger than 1, the natural interpretation is that they are bound states of these lightest solitons. Well, this I said that this Hilbert space is made of modules of the short atypical representation of the supersymmetry algebra with this mass spectrum, but looking twice, the thing is that this mass spectrum formula actually can be understood as a VPS condition for the short representations of not PS22R2, but the quantum deformation of the same dimension. And then this allows to identify what should be the deforming parameter. Forming parameter should be this in terms of K, which is the coupling constant of the semi-symmetric space relativistic model. Well, again, we can make a little comparison with the string S matrix here and say, well, that the semi-classical spectrum consists of a tower of massive states in source symmetric representations, which is very similar to what happens with the magnum bound states of the superstring Gorsi's theory. But in this case, the tower of states is truncated by K, so you should go to the K going to infinity limit to really recover the complete, at least, spectrum of bound states of the string. And it's also interesting to say at this stage that this is the result of doing semi-classical quantization of the solitons using the relativistic axiom. If I do the same, but not using the relativistic axiom, but using the sigma model axiom corresponding to the string, actually, I don't get the truncation. I get an infinite spectrum. It's just a way to say that the semi-classical formulas are okay. So, well, from here, then, we have already a conjecture for the symmetry and even a conjecture for the semi-classical spectrum. We can jump into making a conjecture for the S-matrix. So our conjecture will be an S-matrix with this symmetry, then, that will be constructed as a graded tensor product of elementary blocks with this simple symmetry. So just PS22 with two central extensions. And that is a conjecture that is more or less in agreement with the perturbative results by Juarez. Then these elementary blocks, we will obtain them. We need some relativistic S-matrix to provide those blocks. They will be obtained as a limit of the fundamental matrix constructed by Beiser and Korotev for this quantum deformation of PS22. Close S3. It was constructed in the context, as a quantum deformation of the Hubbard model S matrix. Well, from a different perspective, I remind that I already said that this symmetry algebra, PS22 cross R2, is a finite affine algebra. So, in the sense that it is subalgebra of this affine algebra, infinite affine algebra. And then, actually, the relativistic S-matrix that we construct fits in the known class of S-matrix associated to trigonometric solutions to Jahn-Baster equations associated to affine algebras that were constructed by people in the 90s. Even some people, some of them, like Shangrin or Andrea, are around here, so they know. It should be familiar to them. Okay, so in order to proceed, I have to apologize and I have to write some algebra relations just to say what I am doing. So first of all, I just will write here something about the standard SL 22 algebra. Here, well, you notice that now I am jumping into the complexified of SU22 algebra. But it has the generators are even odd. The even generators just generate the bosonic subalgebra, which is two copies of SL2. And then the odd generators are the supersymmetry generators, which are called with these letters. And then there are three central extensions, and the algebra is written here. So all these questions are normal. The interesting ones are these ones, which is where the centers appear, the three centers. They appear as central extensions of the supersymmetry part. Then an interesting feature of this standard symmetry algebra is that this doesn't have a unique defining representation, but actually has a family of four-dimensional representations which can be labeled by four parameters which satisfy this constraint. I mean, the precise way that appears is when you try to realize explicitly the supersymmetry generators, and those parameters fix the value of the central extensions. They fix them in such a way that then the central extensions, this constraint translates into this constraint, and this is recognized as a shortening or VPS condition to ensure the existence of a four-dimensional representation. Well, this, in past, I say that this is the algebra, and one can notice easily that algebra actually admits a zeta gradation with these grades, and admits an integer gradation because the P and K are centers. And out of that gradation, actually, I can construct a zeta four automorphism, and it is using that how I can write my symmetry algebra as a subalgebra of an affine algebra. And this is what provides the connection with this general construction of a S-matrix that I was mentioning before. Well, actually, we don't need that algebra. We need the quantum deformation of the algebra. But very briefly, the way to quantum deform the algebra is you introduce the Chevalier generators, and you just change commutators and anti-commutators, where instead of having Cartan generators, they are these Q-deformed Cartan generators defined with these symbols. And, well, these are just the normal Cartan step operator commutation relations written in exponentiated form. They involve this Cartan matrix. And here I remember that the deformation parameter is this. Well, the details are not so important. Well, this is for the algebra, but we need the fundamental representation that can be efficiently done just changing the, undeformed generators and multiplying by some factors of Q. And what is interesting is that what happens with the centers. The centers change value. So now the centers were P, K, and C, and they are still expressed in terms of the four parameters that parameterize the fundamental representation. But now the shortening condition has changed. So it gets deformed, and this is the new shortening condition for this fundamental representation of UQ PS22 with the three central extensions. Well, next technical step is that there is a way to an efficient way to parameterize this constants, which is this here. And then the only important thing of this way of parameterizing the constants that exhibits the interpretation of those degrees of freedom. So the degrees of freedom will be divided in three sets. So there are something which is called G and Q, which will be coupling constants. So the algebra will depend on two coupling constants. X plus and X minus are the usual variables used in string S matrix, which are two variables, but that satisfy this constraint. So there's this one variable left. And then there are some normalization factors. Okay? Well, this is the, summarizing that I have this family of fundamental representations with this freedom of these parameters. Now, out of that family, I will single out two particular choices of the representation. One is what we call a Macnon representation, which will be just the usual representation of PS22 with three central extensions that is involved in the construction of the string S matrix. And that is recovered taking the deformation parameter, which is one of the coupling constant, to one, which means that I am undoing the deformation. I go to undeform limit. And fixing this ratio of the other two parameters to be e to the IP. P, obviously, is the worksheet momentum. G, the other coupling constant, is the string tension. And then the deformed shortening condition, which is not deformed anymore, just becomes the usual non-relativistic dispersion relation. OK, this is the usual thing. But for us, we'll be interested in another choice of a representation, which we call soliton representation. Then the soliton representation corresponds to keeping Q fixed and taking the other coupling constant G to infinity. So if I do that, then the ratio of X plus and X minus, which here was the momentum, now is fixed to be the deformation parameter. And importantly, one of the central charges vanishes in that limit, in that representation. And then the important thing is that this the deformed shortening condition now becomes a relativistic mass shell condition. I mean, notice that here C vanishes, so this is not there. So this is like some PK equal to that thing. So I write this in a different way. I introduce the rapidity here, and I relate P and Q in K, so the two centers, to the two components of the momentum, of the worksheet momentum, such that the shortening condition, this, becomes just the mass shell condition for the first, for say, the fundamental particle, so the first soliton. And while this, and since this is very quick, maybe it will not mean anything, but for the experts in S-matrix for affine algebras, the thing is that this choice of rapidity dependence is precisely consistent with the zeta gradation I was introducing a few transparencies before. Well, apart from that, then we have lost one of the centers, and this quantum deformed symmetry has become precisely the quantum deformed symmetry I need for my S-matrix. And then this particular soliton representation then is a soliton representation, is a fundamental representation, which now is labeled by theta. So it's a representation labeled by the rapidity. It's a representation labeled by rapidity, such that it corresponds to the lightest semiclassical solitons. It's like the quantization of the lightest semiclassical soliton representation. And at the same time, if you take the large scale limit, corresponds to the quantization of the perturbative modes. Well, an important structure in this construction is the coproduct. Well, this coproduct was fixed by Weiser and Korotov, who found it as well. And that coproduct involves a new abelian generator, is here. And that tells you that some of these symmetries are non-local. Well, yeah, analyzing this coproduct means that it implies that the centers can be written now in terms of C, one of the centers in this new generator U. We have all these relations. And what is important is that if in the soliton representation, then this new generator becomes somehow, well, not trivial, but U squared becomes 1. So you put U squared equal 1 here and C equals 0, then you notice that the coproduct corresponding to the two centers, to the remaining centers P and K, is, trivial, so in the sense that there is no locality. And that is very important because we are understanding P and K as a components of the momentum. So they are conserved quantities, and they should be local conserved quantities. So this ensures that the interpretation is consistent. And, well, in addition, this U squared is equal to 1 in this limit becomes just the fermion number. So in the Macnon representation, U is like the worksheet momentum. Well, see, this is the algebra, and this is our fundamental multiplet, and now we can jump into the construction of the S-matrix. So then I start with the S-matrix corresponding to the fundamental multiplet. It will be a map, an intertwiner, between the tensor product of incoming states in this fundamental representation, labeled by rapidity, going to outgoing tensor product of the outgoing representation. And since we are in a relativistic theory, this depends on the difference of rapidities. Well, the form of the S matrix will be chosen to be like that. So Y is a scalar factor that is chosen that way. Just to forget about crossing symmetry is automatic. And then R check is the matrix part, which depends on the rapidity. And then that is since we are in this solitonic representation, that will be obtained as the G going to infinity limit of the fundamental R matrix constructed by Weiser and Korotev for this quantum deform symmetry algebra. Well, the form of this R matrix is not so important. The only important thing is that it has an explicit form, so you can write it, you work out the coefficients, and that's it. That exists, I mean, it's a formula. Then, by construction, this S matrix has the symmetry you have conjecture. And, well, as I said before, the form of this additional scalar factors ensures that it satisfies crossing. And then what needs to be imposed is unitarity. So unitarity condition is this. And this allows you to fix the form of this of these scalar factors. Well, of course, the solution, as usual, is not unique, but there is a minimal solution with a minimal number of singularities and all that. So this is quite standard in the context of relativistic S matrix theory. Well, and now we come to the difficult part. I mean, so far we have managed to get a candidate, and the question is that you have to start checking if the candidate gives rise to a consistent theory. And one of the most constraining conditions comes from what is called the Bootstrap program. So the Bootstrap program means that one should be able, if our S matrix amplitudes define a consistent quantum field theory, we should be able to explain all the singularities of the S matrix on the physical strip in terms of bound states, in the direct or cross channels, or in terms of anomalous thresholds. And that is an interesting game that it was played by many people in the past, but it's really very constraining. And when it works, it gives you a very good indication that the construction is consistent. So we have not done the anomalous thresholds, and we have done part of the bound states to a level, and I will tell you what we have got. So concerning the bound states, what do we need to ensure? So the thing is that bound states, everybody knows that give rise to simple poles on the physical strip, and the thing is that the position of those poles have to mesh, has to be correlated with the properties of the representation theory of the quantum group. In which sense? Well, the thing is that if there is a bound state which is produced in the collision of two particles, VA and A and B, so if have A and B produce a bound state, say, C, in the direct channel, then what should happen? Well, it should happen that, first of all, that the corresponding scattering amplitude should have a simple pole on the physical strip for a certain value, imaginary value. Second thing that should happen is that the tensor product of the incoming representation, which is the tensor product of the two incoming particles, which in general is irreducible, should become reducible, and should become reducible in such a way that it decomposes as representation module corresponding to the bound state plus something else. Third thing that should happen is that at that point, the S matrix develops a non-trivial kernel, and the kernel is precisely the complementary space. So somehow, and when I say somehow, I mean somehow, the thing is that the S matrix projects on the bound state module. Somehow means because actually, in general, it's not a projector. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What has to happen is that it's a weighted sum of projectors in the following sense. So the idea is that you have to take the module for the representation module for the bound state. You have to decompose it in as a sum of irreducible representations of the zero-graded subalgebra. In this case, it's just two copies of SL2. And then, I mean, this, I mean, the residues in this pole is like a sun on this. These are not projectors. These are invariant operators that are only non-vanishing on each of the coefficients or each of the components. So this is not exactly a projector. In general, it's not a projector. It's a sum of projectors of this kind. Then, if you ensure all these things, that as you notice, they involve the representation theory of the quantum grouping in a non-trivial way, then you can calculate the scattering amplitudes of that bound state with the previous particles just using a closed formula, which is this. So the scattering of any other particle d with the bound state is going to be written in terms of the scattering of d with the component particles, like that. Okay? Here you see that there are these coefficients that are coming from this decomposition. So this is what should happen, at least to know if our scattering amplitude is compatible with the bootstrap for bound states. And at the same time, this gives me a procedure to construct the bound state amplitudes. Well, then, I mean, to do that, I have to say something about the representation theory of this quantum group. And then, at least for Q, not the root of unity, the thing is that the representations of the quantum deform PS2 to R3 are simply deformations of the undeformed algebra. It is known that they have two kind of representations, ones which are called long or typical, which will be labeled with these curly brackets, has this dimension. They are labeled by two integers, and they are irreducible for generic values of the central extension. But then the interesting thing is that these representations become reducible, but this is decomposable. This is a technical thing that we will not talk about, for specific values of the centers. And the specific values are indicated by particular values of this combination, which are what are called shortening or BPS conditions. Then at those values, then this long representation breaks into two representations, which are then called short or atypical. And the interesting one for us will be this, that I will denote with brackets, with angles. It has this dimension, again, it's labeled by two integers. And then this exists when this shortening condition is satisfied. This, for instance, if you put 0, 0, you get precisely the fundamental representation of dimension 4. And you take M0 and integer 0, you get the representations where we have got our semi-classical solitons. Well, in order to proceed, I need some information about how this short representations behave under tensor products and things like those. So the tensor product of two of them, of these ones, is here. So they, I mean, you multiply two of them and you get a long representation, which in general is irreducible, but you get some of them. And then the splittings of this long representation that we will need to check the bootstrap for the bound states are here. Actually, they allow two different shortening conditions, this and this, and then they decompose like that. So they give us back one of these short representations in both cases and something else. Well, so let's play the game then. We can start with our S matrix for the fundamental modules. So then this is, as I say, is an operator from the tensor product of two of these modules going to reversing the rapidities. And then, using the previous formulas, I noticed that this tensor product is a long representation. Well, here, one of the central extensions was 0. And P and K, because of those coproduct products, are additive. So they are additive and parametrized by rapidity. And then I can look for the shortening condition for this representation. And there is a shortening condition where this decomposes like this, becomes reducible. And at that shortening condition, precisely, gives me a value of the rapidity difference. So then the prediction is that there should be a bound state pole at this rapidity difference. Mm-hmm. Well, should be a bound state pole in the rapidity difference, which should be a bound state living in this short representation. Mm-hmm. Okay? So this is the condition coming from the representation becoming reducible. But as I said before, I need something else. I need to check that the S-matrix, this S-matrix amplitude, gains a non-trivial kernel and actually kills whatever is not in this in the representation module for the bound state. And in this case, actually, it can be checked. I mean, you can do the calculation, and then you show that this, when you here should be the residues of the S matrix at the situation of this pole, actually kills the complementary space of my bound state. So things are okay. So in order to proceed now, then I have to check this thing that at the position of the pole, the residues of the S matrix decomposes as a weighted sum of projectors. So for that, I need to. This is a little bit technical, even more technical. The thing is that I take the modulus of this long representation, and then you decompose the long representation in representations of SL2 plus SL2. Then the decomposition is this. And here one can recognize the module for one of the short representations, and this is the module for the other short representations. And this is what I said, that this becomes, kills this part, is here in formula. So this is the form of these residues, is this, where you see the projectors under these different pieces with some weighting factors that depends on the deformation parameter. So everything works perfectly at this stage. And then from here, you can just jump and construct the S matrix between the fundamental particle and the first bound state. It should be normal formula. Here you have all the tools to do it. So this works. The thing is that it's not trivial that it works, but it works. Now I have to repeat the game. So now I have another S matrix amplitude. Have to look at analytic structure and see if I can understand it in terms of the rules of the game. So in this case, this scattering amplitude, now one can look at that, and one can see that it has four single poles on the physical strip. And actually, then they can be understood in terms of the fusions of this fusion. So this is going to be give you when you tensor product the V1 and V2, is going to give you two long representations. And you look at the shortening conditions for those long representations, you get these fusions. So this is it will be what is this? Yeah, this is the. No, this is wrong. Thing. This is wrong. This should be 0, 0, and 1, 0. That this means that the fundamental particle with the first bound state form a new bound state. This is new. And this another fusion, which is the fundamental particle with the first bound state that gives back the fundamental particle. That gives you two fusions, and then you have to take into account the direct channel and the cross channel, and that accounts for the four simple poles. Again, that's not enough. You should. What is this? Yeah. I forgot to say here that then you can see that in the similar way at the precise position of those fusions, this amplitude kills the complementary spaces of those short representations. So again, the thing works. And in principle, it allows to conjecture that it should work. We haven't checked it forever, but we have checked for the two or three first steps, and it is rather non-trivial, so it seems to work. So the picture that emerged is that the quantum spectrum of particles associated to representations is this, with these mass formulas that are given by the position of the bound state poles. And then the conclusion is that the semi-classical spectrum is exact, up to probably the definition of the mass scale, which is something that is rather standard in the context of two-dimensional integrable systems. Then the picture is that if you take two of these particles and you look at the bound states, they will give rise to two different bound states at these values of the rapidities. And this goes well with the representation theory in the following sense. So if you take the tensor product of two of these the corresponding representations, you write it in terms of long representations, and you look at the shortening conditions, then you will notice that this, at certain value of the rapidity, becomes reducible with the factor representation, which is AB, that gives you the corresponding bound state, and that the corresponding amplitude kills the complementary state. So it works in the sense of the Wooster problem. And then this other one, this latest one, again, is the same. It has a pole where it becomes reducible, and then there is a factor representation like that, and the corresponding amplitude kills also the complementary state. Of course, here in these decompositions, there are more things. There are the problems with the double poles and things like that we haven't analyzed. So this is what we need. It is needed to complete the Wooster program. But the analysis of the bound state spectrum is for us, is rather compelling that the construction makes sense. I mean, all of them are breeders in a sense, but there are no solitons. I mean, these particles look more than breeders than solitons. I mean, they are not purely topological solitons. So they are like breeders. Actually, this truncation of the spectrum of particles is very similar to the truncation of the spectrum of breeders. But these are, I mean, the things that they carry netted and topological charge at the same time. So this. Okay, so this is these are our results, and then I will just sum. There is something else. This was the block to construct the relativistic schematic. This is just, going back to the original problem of what would be the relativistic schematics for the complete model. Then that I said that this was going to be a tensor product, a graded tensor product of schematics, assuming that the particles transform in this graded tensor product of representations. And then, in the relativistic limit, completing this with the scaling factor, or the dressing factor, will be very easy. You just need to add something that supplies the poles that were fixed by the representation theory. And then there is a standard way to do it with a minimal number of singularities. So this is, in this relativistic setting, is more standard. So then, I will just summarize some open questions that we are still have to be solved. So the first and more important would be to complete the closure of the bootstrap. I mean, what I have been telling you is what happens with the bound states. Then, even assuming that the thing goes, it's only the bound states, but there are more singularities. So, closure of the bootstrap is a complicated business. And in particular, there is the question of the truncation of the spectrum. I mean, we haven't said how the spectrum truncates. But I mean, the simplest possibility would be if really Q is of this form and K is an integer, then Q is a root of unity, and one knows that the representation theory of quantum groups as root of unity is a little bit different and actually truncates. But in this case, one needs to understand better the representation theory of root of unity of these quantum groups, which is not so well developed in the literature. Well, other things which are open, another interesting thing would be to understand better the analytic structure underlying the relativistic schematics. I mean, I said several times that there is an infinite loop algebra or infinite quantized loop algebra behind. It would be good to understand that in the sense of an infinite algebra. And in that sense, I think it would be interesting to make contact with this recent work by Weiser, Gallis, and Matsumoto, where they wrote an infinite quantum algebra for precisely the Q-deform S-matrix that we have used. And of course, another open question is to make connection with the semi-classical quantizations of Seylin collaborators, because if the connection is not obvious. And now let me finish just posing the golden question, which has been around, which is how the relativistic schematics can be equivalent to a non-relativistic one. This is many people have been asking that. The answer is I don't know yet, but at least we have some clue now. I mean, the scenario that emerges from all this is that there should be some non-relativistic interpolating schematics. So there should be some S-matrix, that could be some S-matrix that depends on the two constants, G and Q, so that in one limit, in the Q1T1, so the underform one, you get the non-relativistic string Magnum S matrix, And in the other limit, you go into infinity, you get the relativistic S matrix of the four-major reduced system. And in between, you have some object. I mean, the construction of that object, we have a lot, because the R matrix that does that, we already know. That is the Weiser-Korotev R matrix. So actually, this is naturally in a sense, because that would be like the quantum version of the interpolating family of classical Poisson brackets. I mean, it's precisely what happens with the Poisson brackets. But then what needs to be done to complete the thing is construct the interpolating Dressing function. So we have the Dressing function in the relativistic limit, and we have a Dressing function for the non-relativistic limit that it was difficult to get. Then it should be possible to dress the R matrix of Weiser and Korotev with some Dressing function such that this picture is complete. And that is something we are working on it at the moment, and we'll hope that this will be possible. This is all. Thank you very much for your attention. It's a mass scale. It is free. It is free. But it was a, I mean, the thing is that the thing is that a mass scale has been there from the very beginning. So here, in the Polmeyer reduced action, the thing, well, is we are used not to write it, but this potential term, you can rescale this fixed element lambda by scale. That is a mass term. So this should be proportional to mu squared. So this is actually, you forget about the fermions. This looks like a conformal field theory with a relevant perturbation that introduces a mass scale. And that's the reason why the soliton spectrum is massive. Mm-hmm. And that mass scale, in principle, it renormalized, but it remains free. It doesn't run. I mean.
More questions?
So you can see the theory on a plane, right?
Sorry?
You are considering this theory on a plane. And originally, if you start from string theory, sigma model, you get a model on a cylinder. What is the physical interpretation of the radius of this cylinder? What parameter, what physical parameter you need to send to infinity to get from a cylinder plane?
You mean what is the interpretation back in the, say, in the original problem?
I mean if you perform this reduction by using the string sigma model, you get a model defined on a cylinder. You start from a cylinder, you get a cylinder, right? Then somehow, instead of considering this model, this Lagrangian defined on a cylinder, you consider this model defined on a plane. So what is the physical interpretation of the parameter of the radius of the cylinder? You need to send something to infinity to get a plane.
No, but I am following, I mean, standard approach in the context of integrable theories. The thing that I start with my theory is defined on all the Minkowski space. There is no cylinder there. So I get the S matrix, but now with that S matrix, I can put the system, if I want, in a cylinder. So I can write, for instance, the corresponding TVA equation for that S matrix.
Then what is the physical interpretation of the radius of this cylinder?
The physical interpretation of the radius, that I don't know. I don't actually know what is the interpretation of the resulting quantum theory back in the original problem. This is one of the open questions. So, for instance, I don't know what is the interpretation of Q. in the string theory, or of course not in the Superjahn Mills. That would be even if I manage to write this interpolating S matrix, the question will be that in between the two things, what is the interpretation of the object? I mean, at least I guess that it should be useful, because that should allow me to transport information from this relativistic regime where there are things that work very well, like the bootstrap or even the TBA equations are organized in a certain way. Maybe they could be transported to the using this interpolating trajectory back to the string, and maybe should be useful to understand something better. But I don't know. What I have done is analyzing the two-dimensional integrable system by itself so far. This is one of the open questions. I must say that this interpolating picture was not the one that we were expecting. We were expecting maybe to have some more direct connection, but this emerged from the analysis of the model.
So if there are no more questions, let's thank Luis again.